Hey everybody, welcome to Where's the Hook? I'm Spiffy Man, and this is the rest of the Spiffy Recordings crew.
What's up? My name's Sonix.
I'm Stasis.
I'm Alagon.
Flex Bormar.
And today we got all sorts of topics to bring up today, starting with different size monitors for different size rooms. What do you think about that, Matt? Like, what are your opinions on that?
Most of the time, smaller monitors can get you by. So, like, think of like a 5-inch monitor, say like a Rocket K or K5 or something like that. Most of the time, that can get you by. But there's a trade-off that comes to having a smaller monitor is the bass response of those monitors. So in order for the speakers to resonate lower frequencies, the cone of the speaker needs to move further distances. So when the speaker is smaller, it isn't able to move those larger distances. So if you got like an 8-inch speaker, like a KRK-8, for example, or a Yamaha HS-8, then those cones can move larger and create those lower frequencies.
Right. That makes sense. Because I've been running these M Audio speakers for the last 10 years, and they were made just for like acoustic recordings. So there's like limited to like no sub bass response. They're so small, you know? So anytime I have to do like bass editing, I'm doing it with my studio headphones.
I was doing it similarly. I was using the Beyer Dynamics for the low end and using the HS7s while I was just generally producing. But ever since I got the HS8s, I'm like, I'm getting the mixes in 2 tries instead of 6. And the reason I wanted to bring this up as a talking point is because I was advised, I think poorly, by like the people at Guitar Center and the people on Reddit, because I was always told that smaller monitors are the way to go, because in a bedroom, it will introduce, like those low frequencies will introduce bass resonance problems. But I found that as long as you're producing at a reasonable volume, not so much.
Well, were you mentioning to the people at Guitar Center what it was you were trying to do? Like what you're making?
Electronic dance.
Find a better fucking job.
Because I feel like they're geared more towards like the home recording artists, people who want to do vocals or recording their guitars and stuff. And obviously they don't want those heavy bass responses in those acoustic recordings.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it's that they're most of the people that were working there are from like another world of music production.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way they don't know is when you're post-producing those sounds, you could just filter out those low frequencies.
Yep.
So maybe they're a little untrained, and you can't fault them for that.
Right.
No.
Because it's not their job to assess your own mixing capability. They're just like, well, this is what we know. So.
Their job is to sell stuff to you.
Yeah, and if anything, I would blame myself for like assuming that I'm talking to like a full-blown expert.
Right.
You know?
Always try to do as much research on your own at a time.
Yeah.
Like if Dead Mouse is working at Guitar Center.
Yeah, right. That's how I was talking to them. Yeah.
I think what's one cool thing about monitors is on the HS8s, they don't have these, but on the KRK Rockets, sometimes you'll see this. There's a little slit on the bottom of the speakers that gives you a kind of like, I guess, a passageway into the back of the box that the speaker is in. What that allows the speaker to do is throw more of the low frequencies forward instead of backwards. So most of the time when you have monitors in a closed box, like an HS8, it's going to throw a lot of the lower frequencies backwards towards because it has that port behind the speaker. But what the KRKs do is it puts that port in front of the speaker, so it allows it to throw those sub frequencies forward more. So it makes KRKs more conducive to producing dance music because you can hear the sub more.
Right. And you can push it closer to the wall so you can have more space in your room.
Yes. But if you're trying to make a studio, that's actually not a good thing to do. Put it close to the wall.
Right.
If you're trying to wow your friends with the bass, put your speakers close to the wall. As Steve's taking a big swig.
In college,
drink to that.
in college, the acoustics in our apartment my senior year was pretty wild, and my buddy had an external subwoofer connected to his monitors, and we called it the bass cave, the way the bass was resonating in just like two corners of the room.
Yeah,
it was just fucking beautiful. But it was crappy because like when you're sitting right there, it wasn't doing a good enough job. But if you were standing at the back corner, like over there, it was like perfect. It was like exactly what you wanted. But that's another thing too, is think about how you're going to acoustically treat your studio, and then go forward figuring out what speakers and subs you want to accompany. Yeah.
I need to learn more about that. I don't know anything about that. You were saying, you were looking at my room, like the best place to start would be like the corners above the wall where your setup is, with bass traps.
Yeah, so Steve, when you were talking about like the bass cave of where you want to hear your basses is going into the like the back corner of the room. Yeah, if you go into the back corner of your room, you're going to hear those basses, but for like the grand scheme of your room and from a producing perspective, you want to have as flat of a frequency curve as you can, so you're getting the best representation of your song as possible.
Right.
So that's why acoustic treatment companies invented these things called bass traps, and they're designed to be put in your corners because that's where bass frequencies like to build up.
Mm-hmm. In front and behind.
Right. In front and behind, but mostly in front. Right behind your monitors. And like we can even show like, so I did a sound test of my room that shows the EQ profile where you can see all the resonances, like the highs and lows. I don't have bass traps in my studio right now, but you can see how like crazy the resonances in the low end are. But as you get to like the mids and the highs, it's very tame when it comes to resonances. It's pretty much flat. Yes. So bass frequencies would take those resonances and would bring them down close to even.
What are your guys' setups for audio, Alex and Andy?
I have these, man. That's one of my speakers died, so my studio monitors just don't exist
on headphones.
I mean, like I said it last time, I've never even like produced through the speakers themselves. I've just produced through headphones and then listened through the speakers afterwards to see, you know, if there was something either too high or too low through those.
I think Skrillex had the same approach for his first album.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, he was just going off of one speaker, and it was... No, Cinema. Was it one speaker, or was it one... Or was it headphones, and he only had the right side? Oh.
Cinema. The Cinema remix. Yeah.
You are
the Benny Benassi. Cinema.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I want you forever.
Yeah.
And that's gnarly, awesome. Man. Yeah. Making music based off of just one speaker is just... so difficult to do. But then, like I said, like headphones like play a huge part in helping out in those situations.
Yeah, you fine tune with headphones.
Right.
That's how I use headphones. Most of it's done on monitors, and then when you need to get in with like a fine tooth comb is when the headphones come out.
I feel like using headphones for me helps me hear the stereo spectrum better. Like if I want to hear what's in the left and right speaker more, and how wide my track is, then I'll put the headphones on to hear that.
Yeah.
Or if my girlfriend's bitching at me for being too loud late at night.
Yeah, for headphones, I mostly just use them for just mixing now, but like tracks like Tin Can, I was doing it to get a better feel for like the panning I was doing with a lot of my synth work, especially for the percussion. Because like I'd be having stuff bouncing really low, but like side to side really fast, you know, with the idea that you're going to be like high as a kite listening to the track, right? Like, you're at a festival and this is playing and you're tripping balls. You're going to be hearing stuff over here, but then there's something else happening over here, you know, so.
But those are the little ear candy things you leave for your listener.
Yeah.
Right.
A very simple but effective tactic is that fucking wide ping pong delay.
Have you guys ever heard of the Haas effect?
Yes.
H-A-A-S?
Yeah.
If you have it for the listener, basically it's a ping pong delay where the delay is tuned extremely fast but not fast enough so that it gives a sound like a stereo effect. So if you like took like a mono, yeah, like a slapback, but more tighter. So if you took like a bass, like this is, don't do this, but if you took like a kick that's in mono,
I actually play with kicks. Like, I'm not kidding. On the track that I did with Steven, the sleeper, there is a delay and a reverb on the kick, which is a very quick delay that's almost like a slapback.
Yeah.
Not recommended if you don't know what you're doing.
What's a slapback for those that don't know?
I would say it's like a super quick delay that's, you can hear it, but it's not in time with the song.
Okay. I didn't know what that was.
Yeah. Like, I'm thinking like a Haas effect is even tighter than a slapback. Like, you wouldn't even hear the delay. It would just sound like the song is wide, or the instrument is wide. Like, that's how tight the delay is. Like, I do it to vocals sometimes.
Yeah, where you place them slightly out of time.
Yeah.
So if you have two vocal layers, one is set like maybe half of the 16th note forward.
Yeah. So like when I was processing Robbie's vocals for your song Angel, I took one of the background vocals in the stems and I put the Haas effect on it to make it wider, and it kind of sounded like a double, but it was a harmony, so it complemented the lead vocal well, because the lead vocal is in the middle and then the Haas effect spread it left and right of the vocal, and they kind of just sat better in the mix.
Nice.
So
I love you for that.
Yeah, no problem. Kids. What?
Nothing.
Monetization. All right, moving on.
All right.
So what is something you guys do in your songs that you would consider a lazy production?
Literally, but, like, everything good. I do within my will, like, that's just everything.
Well, okay, so is are we saying lazy is a negative in this situation?
Yeah, lazy is not always negative, actually.
Yeah, because one thing I do with like my plucks, I have a preset for the mixer set for my plucks.
But you made that
for it works,
right? But
it's not lazy, you just weren't prepared for it,
I guess.
But this is a positive example of laziness.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So lazy isn't always negative.
I don't know. I think using samples for like bass lines, melody, something that you know you have to make on your own. I think I've noticed people using them, and when I tell you that, because I've heard them, I heard the samples on Splice, and then I go to Spotify and I heard that same sample, and I'm like, oh, you motherfucker, you use that shit.
So and, I mean,
you're not talking about one shots though, right? You're talking about
I'm not talking
like a bass melody.
Shots. Like I don't use Splice for kicks. I use Splice for like hats, claps, or even like weird texture effects, but not for like chords, bass lines, arps, or anything like that. But I mean, since I'm on Splice, I go through them because they are there. But it happens a lot, like even on a Vinny Vici song, I heard a bass from Splice there on one of his songs.
Man.
And I was like, oh, no, you did not.
Well, but, I mean, just go to show sometimes.
But it worked.
Yeah, some artists have a little hard time sometimes, like filling in space that like the melodies will fill in. So yeah, right. I do think that's kind of lazy. Because like, I think it's fine if you get like those bass melodies and then you just like, you cut the sample so you can just use one note from the bass and make something else out of it.
And it's all about being creative with the actual sample, because I've used a lot of samples for effects, but I don't use it exactly as I found it. Like I will change the pitch, I would reverse it or add layers on it, stuff like that too, you know. Okay, so I have this now as an artist, I have to show being, you know, my creative side and, you know, how I can manipulate it into my track.
Right. So I guess I would say it's negative if you're thinking of releasing a track and you're just using the sample melody that's given. Because then there's like there might be other people who have done the same exact thing. So then your track is no longer original.
Dude, I would even go as far as to say it makes what you're trying to do more difficult because now you're forcing yourself to work into something else.
Right.
You're adapting to that, to the existing template.
Sometimes, or if the loop ended up working in your song, then the loop is fitting into your song.
Yes.
So it depends. Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't be afraid to use loops, but try to like add some extra effects to it to make it a little more original.
Creative.
There's
what were you gonna say, Steve?
No. I'm thinking of a name of something. I'm thinking there's a VST that kind of goes along the lines of like those loop samples.
Is it the Captain plugins?
I think it's Output. Is that what it's called?
Output.
Yeah.
Output Arcade.
Well, that's the company.
That's the company. It's Arcade, right? Is that what you said?
Arcade, yeah.
Yeah. That one's completely sample based. I guess it's not a synthesizer, it's a sampler. But they always say, like, oh, you use this and you can make your music, you can make tracks like super easy. And I feel like, in a way, that's lazy production.
Honestly, man, like, I had a subscription with Output Arcade for 6 months, and I never was able to make a song, anything from what it had. I think
it's too restrictive.
It was too restrictive. If I had to make something from it, I had to bounce it to audio. There were more steps involved in order for me to get it to sound the way I wanted.
Right.
It's a good idea starter for sure, but to use it to create a finished track, I don't know. It's more work than it was worth it, so that's why I ended my subscription.
No, I agree, because I did the 1 month free subscription, and it wasn't for like those.
I remember
it was
for like did.
I did, and I was while we were working on Agartha, and it was to try to get like their, they have some spooky sounds, like some spooky libraries.
You know, I got you with that,
those.
Man.
They're like drones and stuff. And to me, it was just like if I found a pack of those, like a regular sample pack of those. So I would render them and save them. You know? But I never used, like the ARPs and stuff for some of the packs. I just couldn't get anything out of them.
Same thing with Cthulhu, like we were talking about. Like, I bought that thinking it was going to
Gonna be sounding like Deadmau5.
I thought it was gonna be a huge help, but it actually, it's really just an idea starter, as you said.
Yeah.
And it can actually help you generate chords.
I just bought it, so I have barely even touched it. I've been messing around with it, but I got nothing out of it so far.
Okay. It's gonna be like that for a while.
I've only used it for 20 minutes.
Idea starters are important, but that's its role. Idea starter.
Right.
For me.
I bought Cthulhu, and then I realized that Ableton had an arpeggiator in it already.
That has all the same Bach chorales.
Yeah, Logic. Yeah, I actually use Logic's arpeggiator more than
FL has. Purchase. FL Studio has an arpeggiator as well.
I don't think it's that complex, though.
Tutorial about the use of FL's arpeggiator.
Yeah. I used to use it a couple of years ago to get some songs started. You know, but what ended up happening was that like whatever it gave me, I just created something completely different from what it started with. So
some people say to use Captain Chords to start some songs. Honestly, I don't have a good experience with Captain Chords and Captain Beat.
Wait, what is that?
It's too much. I got it personally to reduce the amount of steps it would take to create a chord.
Poor baby.
And it did not accomplish that. It takes more steps, actually.
Because you'll hear something that you like pieces of?
I like pieces of, and then I'll hear it, but honestly, I'm faster. Because I'm like classically trained, I'm faster if I just like make it myself.
So then that goes along the lines of if you're like classically trained for a cool minute, it's harder to use some of those things. So those tools are more geared for the lesser educated musically.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, it would help them a lot for sure. But if you're classically trained, no.
But they have great advertising. So people at our level of production will see them, think that we might be able to benefit from them. and then we end up wasting our money.
Right.
Waste mine.
You want to talk about the hi-hat thing that fit well into the lazy production?
Oh yeah,
format.
So here's a bit of lazy production that I do personally that is a positive form of lazy production. So you could put all your hi-hats into like a drum rack in Ableton. I'm not sure what it's called in FL, like a drum machine thing in FL.
I guess in FL you would take a hat and put it on a chin.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in Ableton they have a drum rack, which looks like a grid of pads, and you can link them to a MIDI pad if you want, and you can like make a beat with them. But anyway, so in the longer method of doing that is taking a couple hi-hats, maybe four, and then adjusting the velocities of each hit in the MIDI clip in order to make it sound human or dynamic or stuff like that. So like one hat sounds louder or harder hitting than the other. But one kind of lazy thing I do is I just load up the drum rack with a bunch of different hi-hat sounds and then just layer the hi-hats hits on top of each other so that some sound harder hitting than others. And then you get a more dynamic hi-hat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Without adjusting the velocities at all.
Because okay. You're essentially achieving the same result. Because First of all, each of the samples are naturally going to have different velocities than the other. And secondly, especially when they're stacked on top of each other.
Yeah. Sometimes, though, you have to end up putting a compressor on that bus to make kind of tame the...
You're scaring Angel. You're scaring him.
I don't do that.
I said the dangerous word, compressor.
We don't compress here, all right? We don't do that.
That's another thing. You need to learn how to compress. If you're going to be a professional producer, compression is important.
Very key.
Yes.
You just turn the sound goodizer up to 100. That's what I do.
Yeah.
Or the sausage fattener up.
Or the sausage fattener.
Oh, or both. Sausage fattener. If it doesn't look fucking angry as shit, it's not high enough.
Dude, speaking to plugins like that, in Speaker Honey's stream the other day, you guys know Systems, that other mousetrap artist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He happened to be sitting in, and I mentioned Sound Goodizer, and he was like, yo, Sound Goodizer fucking slaps. So I guess
I remember that. I remember that.
Like, even these pros are using the plugins that the experts of Reddit consider to be cheating.
So when it comes to like Reddit advice and stuff like that, I feel like people just think because it's stock, it's not going to be good.
Yep.
Yeah, there's just a lot of prejudice to stock plugins. Like, Ableton has some beautiful stock plugins to use. FL has a lot. Like all my mastering is stock plugins from FL, you know?
Same.
So you just gotta learn how to use it. I have Waves to do all the mastering, but I got so good with the FL stuff, it's like, I don't really need that stuff.
And it works for you.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, if I want to make it, like, elevate the sound, I should probably start using it, but I feel like my sound's pretty clean, pretty good.
Where FL is lacking is in its stock DSTs, I will say that.
Yeah.
Ableton's pretty good with that.
Operator.
Operator's pretty good. I have to say the true mark of a professional is being able to wield his current set of tools with ease and stuff like that. So if you think like, this is a okay analogy, but if you have a knight on a battlefield, all he has is whatever he has. But if he can beat the shit out of everybody with his mace and sword or whatever he has, he's a fucking pro. He doesn't need a sword and a mace and a bow and arrow and all this stuff. That would just weigh him down.
Right.
So if you become a pro at the tools you have, then that's all you need.
Right.
Do you guys use, or Alex and Steven, since you guys both use FL, do you use, make use of any stock synths?
I do.
Operators do.
Back in the day, this was because of Seamless on YouTube. I got really, good using Harmer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was because of his teachings on the his tutorials. So I did use that for a while. But a lot of the sounds that I can make in the stock stuff, I make in Silence anyway. So I found no reason to really use all that stuff. Yeah. Like, you can use Citrus for pads, and I did for the longest time. And then I learned how to do it on Massive and Silent, and so then eventually I just moved it all to Silent. And then, like, my plucks, I did it in Wasp.
I remember Wasp, yeah.
Yeah, so I started plucks
y'all
with Wasp.
Y'all are fucking old, Jesus Christ.
And then I went from Wasp over to Zeta, right? And then from Zeta I went to Silent.
Did you ever use Zeta Plus 2?
Yes. I still have it. When I first broke into like more synthwavy stuff, I was using that a lot.
Dude, it's not a bad synth.
No, it's not.
Say, I use... So, I'll fuck around with pretty much any stock plugin that I have or that I purchase, just to be like... Like, I know in Aperture I used, I think, Harmer. Which one comes with FL when you buy it? Is it Harmer or Harmless?
Harmless.
Harmless.
Okay, so I had to buy Harmer, because back in the day when I started Aperture a couple years ago, I had a cracked version of FL, so I had Harmer in like this main atmosphere that just plays quietly in the back is Harmer. So I'm like, alright, now that I have FL, I can't finish this project, so I gotta buy Harmer. So I have Harmer, I think I bought, what is it, SAR, just to fuck with that. I think I bought Toxic Biohazard, just to fuck with that too.
Oh, Toxic
Biohazard. So I'll fuck with those. I'll mess around with Citrus every once in a while. And then right before I started Enter Sleep, the 20-minute track, someone said in the chat, they took a screenshot of GMS, and they were like, yo, this shit's fucking crazy. Like, am I drunk, or is this actually a good plugin to use? And I was like... Yeah. And so I loaded it up, and the main bass that is in Enter Sleep, that's from GMS.
Okay.
Dude, that's not a bad plugin either. No, also, the Wave Shaper is FL's best kept secret. It offers great saturation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were tweaking your track earlier, and you had a lead in the drop, and I told you that the lead sounded too clean, so you put the Wave Shaper on it, and it actually like gave it more grit and made it felt like it belonged at the drop.
Absolutely. First preset as well.
First preset. He like picked it. I'm like, yeah, that's tight. And then you start flipping through and I'm like, no. Just go back.
That's usually how it works.
All right, so then there we can circle back to lazy techniques again. And it goes to presets.
Yeah.
Presets lazy.
Presets are okay. You can use them. I'm meaning it's okay to use them.
Okay. Because I feel like a lot of people are afraid. Like, I know in college I joined this EDM club on campus, and a lot of them were electronic production courses, right? For I can't remember the name of the degree, but it was along those lines. So they're all analog kids working with analog software, right? And then I got in an argument with them because I was showing them what I was working on. They're like, oh, that's cool, but it's all samples. If you're just using samples and presets, I'm like, I mean, I'm making stuff using the Silent. I'm using a synthesizer to make stuff. I'm like, yeah, but that's all sample-based too. And I'm like, I mean, I guess, but there's nothing wrong with that. And they're like...
Yeah, they were saying, like, that's not original or something?
Yeah, they're like, oh, well, you know, all digital synthesizers are not real. They're all samples. Like, it's just a sample of a saw that you manipulate. And then they'll bring out, like, their modulators. And, like, this is, like, how you make real sound. And they weren't very good at what they were making.
Just start
so
plugging
like
in wires in random places.
Yeah, and so I'm like, your argument's pretty crappy because you guys aren't making really good sounds with that. But
yeah, well, why do you use a guitar in all your rock songs? Why do you use a bass guitar in all your rock songs? Same thing.
So, So I feel like a lot of people are scared, like, oh, I don't want them to find out that this is a preset.
Yeah. Dude, you hear a lot of that type of talk. It's worse in the DJ community than it is in the production community. But the whole concept of, like, a real DJ, like, uh-huh. the vinyl people are fucking insufferable.
Dude, it's crazy. Yeah.
And it always struck me as so ironic because, like, you have one hell of an ego for someone that's not writing music. Like, well, you're playing other people's music.
It's a whole different mindset, and I remember Armin van Buuren talking about this. Those people back then were they just focused on playing music. They didn't work on making their own music. So the goal is different now. Yeah. We want to DJ not because of DJing. We want to DJ because we want to get our music out there. So yep. not to show our skills of, you know, of spinning.
Right.
I mean, that's a whole different topic.
Right. Because, like, I'm the same way. Like, I know how to DJ, but I'm not the best, like, spin master, you know? I'm not, like, doing crazy, like, mixes between tracks. Not making a remix out of the decks, you know?
Yeah, because we're not turntablists. We're producers. Yeah,
correct. Like, I perform my music, and then I make videos and stuff for the performance. You know, that's my performance. I'm not a turntablist.
Yes.
You know, like, I'm pretty amateur when it comes to that. Like, I can do some of that stuff. I learned how to do it, but I'm so out of practice. I'm not, like, switching between the faders real quick, scratching like crazy. But also because there's no need, especially in EDM, there's no, like, heavy need
for
that.
They just want to dance.
Most of it's for the floor.
For the record, though, producing is way harder than DJing. Unless you're doing that crazy scratch shit.
Yeah, because you have probably the most experience in both worlds.
Yeah.
Of any of them.
DJing is easy as fuck. And you should stop paying wedding DJs thousands of dollars to press buttons.
Yeah.
It is the easiest job in the world, and they get paid a lot. Mm-hmm. So.
Like, if, yeah. Because I have that issue. Like, I know a lot of people who just DJ, right? And they'll complain about, like, people not wanting to pay their, like, high prices. Then I'm like, dude, I'll go DJ for them for, like, $300 and free booze. And the $300 is just my gas to get there and to set up the equipment, man.
Wait, they want more than $300?
Dude, yeah. There are DJs that'll be, like, my starting fee for the first hour is $400 and then $150 every hour after.
What?
That's a low price.
That's a cheap price. Yeah, like I was saying, wedding DJs are $4,000 to $6,000 for a wedding.
Dude, and here we are praying that someone will buy one of our tracks for $1.29.
Yeah, man,
it's different. It's completely different. Like, what we do is art. We do art. We don't. It's a different thing. We're not just here to see people dance. We don't do it for the money. There's so much stuff into it. What we do requires a lot of mind. It requires being creative. You know, it making the music that you make comes from who you are and what you've been through. You know, playing music out there is just, you just learn how to mix for a few days and then you're getting paid fucking thousands of dollars. But, you know, creating one song is putting your heart, putting your mind into it, and that's art. It's completely different. I think it's completely stupid to actually just compare DJing and producing. It's just a whole different thing, whole different job.
Yeah.
I just want to put it out there. We're not shitting on, like, professional DJs and that's all they do. But, like, the ones that just are just messing with the crossfader and that's it, and they're just playing music, they're charging, like, thousands of dollars. I mean, they're ripping
people off. We're not even crossfading. We're not even crossfading and getting paid $4,000 to $6,000.
Yeah. Majority of the time, they just have a playlist playing and then they just have, like, the auto fade on.
I know a guy that does various parts. I don't know what his prices are. They're definitely not, like, $6,000 for a wedding, but he just has a playlist in a program that's just automatically just one song to the next. And he's just there to make sure the sound goes.
Yeah.
That's a great racket.
Dude, what a shitty job, though. Like, you'd be so bored, like, if that's your life and that's all you do.
Yeah.
Fucking pathetic.
Yeah. Very I think it'd be cool to make a quick buck, but I think over the long term, you don't really have a purpose in life, and it just kind of gets depressing.
Yeah, you don't feel fulfilled.
I'd be a wedding DJ if I didn't have to do any like announcements, like, and here comes the bride and groom.
Yeah.
If I could just be silent, it might be a nice way to make.
We're gonna make you do that, Steve.
Just bring Matt with you. He can do the speaking part.
Yeah.
There you go.
Hey, come on down.
All right.
What's our next?
Amount of time it takes to produce a song.
I'm out.
You two, Steven and Matt, you guys are good with this. You could probably lead it off.
Okay.
Well, I think it definitely depends on your skill level, first of all. If you're like very new to
Alright, Steve, let me set the premise of this conversation.
Right. Okay.
So the ultimate goal of this topic is to give newer producers a target to shoot at. So and what professional music production looks like. So it may take you a month to finish a track, but in a professional music world, you should be able to start a track and finish the master in 8 hours. That's what the professional music world looks like. Eight working hours. If you can't do that, like, you need to find ways to cut your time down. Otherwise, and I'll give you an anecdote of a friend of mine. So he got a small publishing deal with Sony, and Sony wanted him to produce 4 tracks for them, and they wanted the tracks in 2 weeks. So if that is like freaking you out, like that's what the professional world looks like. So you need to be able to produce those tracks like off the bat, super quick.
Oh yeah, no, because I get, when I do independent films, I get that same amount of heat. They're like 15-minute films, and then like I have to make like a new song for every other minute in the film. And you only have 2 weeks, right? Since I'm doing the mastering myself and the mixing, so I need all that. But I can do all that in a week. And that's because I have to do like show the director, and they're like, oh, well, I want this changed. But you're right, 8 hours. 8 hours and you're golden. Like, a week ago, Speaker Honey's challenge, monthly challenge. She's all right, you have 1 week to make a song that uses an original vocal that you recorded, right? I came in, I started it like right after it was announced, and I hated what I was working on. So I started from scratch 3 hours before, mixed and mastered and sent it in.
And it came out pretty decent, dude.
That's pretty impressive. 3 hours, nice.
And that was in 3 hours. And then nobody believed it. Nobody believed that it was in 3 hours either. Like, the whole chat, there's like, there's no way you did this like just a few hours ago. There's no way. I'm like, no, dude, I'm just like, I've been doing this for so long. It's very, like, my process.
Can we dive deeper into that? Part of the thing that allows you to work with speed, I think, is not second guessing your decisions.
So when you first start, you're obviously going to always second guess what you're doing. You know, that just comes with the territory of getting into something new. Like, because majority of the time, you don't have somebody sitting right next to you saying, okay, well, you need to do this, we need to do that. You know, for me, I was on my own for a good 7 years before I started talking to more people.
Right.
Nobody was telling me, so I was second guessing myself all the time. Now I'm just like, all right, I'm just gonna do it real quick, and then I'll send it to you guys, and then if you guys have something to say, like, all right, I can go fix that. But other than that, it's like, I'm good.
Do you guys know the song Soulja Boy, or Crank That by Soulja Boy?
Yeah.
Can you guys guess how long it took him to make that song?
It sounds like a 10-minute song.
30 minutes.
Oh, shit.
It took him 30 minutes to make that song.
And he just put the soft clipper on?
Have you heard the song Lean On?
He made it in the trial version of FL Studio.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah,
that's awesome. Love those stories.
So just don't second guess yourself. Just do it.
The other thing I was going to say to that point is I'm new to finishing tracks within a week. This is very new. This is like within the past month new. Okay. But it's been working for me because you can fuck up your decisions by sitting on something for too long. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing that for a long time without realizing it. I've been fucking up my ideas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely so have.
Getting them done and getting them out as fast as possible is can be more valuable than you think it is.
And what's weird is that it feels like it's counterintuitive. It doesn't feel right as you're doing it. But then once you're finished and you look back at the product, you're like, oh shit, it worked better. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought?
Mm-hmm.
So a challenge to the newbies out there: set a timer and finish your track in 8 hours, start to finish.
Yeah.
Do you remember what my, or you weren't there. So we were at a friend of mine's place last Friday, and I think it was after Matt left, but he was saying that when he has a song that he is preparing to submit to a large label, he will make sure that he takes a month to make sure that everything in every place is absolutely perfect.
I do that.
And I would think, dude, you're shooting yourself in the foot by doing
that's
that.
That's terrible.
You're going to find things wrong with it that aren't actually wrong with it.
Mm-hmm. Because you'll be sitting there and then you'll hear like a little thing and you'll be like, that might be a problem. It might not be. But then it festers in your mind and then you start making it a problem.
Dude, a month is so much time to waste too.
Yeah.
Dude, just ship it. Like, I've worked in manufacturing before. Just ship your product. Like, the most important thing you can do is ship your product.
Yeah.
So get it out the door. And that month will be too long. I would say like a few days would be cool.
Sit on it for a few days and make adjustments.
Yes, but not a month. Fuck that. You would have produced 4 new songs by then, at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That may have been better than that one.
Yeah, that could have been better. That were probably going to be better because you're now a better producer.
You've acquired experience.
You've acquired experience. So don't waste time.
Yes.
Get it out the door.
Right.
And I'm extremely new to this mindset.
Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult one to get into. I will admit it is a very difficult one to get into. But then once you've done it enough times, it's a natural thing to do. Just like breathing. You just do it.
Yes.
So.
What else we got, Matt?
What time are we at? I think we've been talking for a while.
Podcast-wise, we're probably at like 45 minutes, give or take.
All right, cool. We still got 15 minutes.
All right. Let's talk about pros and cons of remixes when it comes to... And this includes official and unofficial remixes.
Okay. So I want to break it down then. Before we get into that one then, you have to explain the difference between a bootleg and a remix. Because I feel like a lot of people don't understand the differences. And because you can have a remix and then an unofficial remix, but I feel like unofficial remixes will have a backing from the artist still, but they can't officially say it's like a real remix. Like I did a remix for Tyler, for Skyline Drive, right? For a track he released with Jan Martin. And I really liked it, he really liked it, Jan really liked it. But Silk, they didn't like it enough to release it. So they said he can post it, you know, for everybody to listen to for free, but he has to say it's a bootleg. He's not allowed to say it's a remix. We're not in fully
enforcing. Why didn't Silk like it?
Oh, they never. Majority of the time, they don't say. You know.
You should post that song in the show notes, so that people can hear it. Because honestly, my definition of a bootleg is you're not using it. You're not using like you're next to using no new samples or sounds. You're pretty much taking the samples that are already there.
As if it was a radio rip.
As if it was a radio rip, and you're creating something new. So. Yeah. You just think about Blau's origins, mm-hmm. How he started with bootlegs. He just put two songs together.
Right.
But that's not what you did.
Right, no, not at all. Mm-hmm. So we're making that clear, and I'll include the definitions in the video. between the two, so people a little more understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then now to push on to like remixes versus official remixes. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But your remix has to have like you in it. You know, you can't just like kind of cut up the song, add one little synth, but it's still basically mimicking something in the song, and then say it's a remix. That goes back to lazy production. So like I haven't done a remix of anything in a while, but the last remix I did, an unofficial remix, was for Phantoms Can't Hang by Deadmau5.
Mm-hmm.
And it was trance. It was a progressive trance remix. And the only thing that I kept the same was his little blip melody. Right? And then everything else was kind of a little more original, following his like chord structure. But yeah. So for remixes, that's kind of the way to go, in my opinion.
Dude, so you guys are familiar with Pretty Lights, obviously.
Oh yeah.
Many of his songs are contain snippets existing exactly as they are in the original song, yeah. In his, but yeah, it's so all arranged in a unique and creative way.
Yeah, so he's sampling. So
that's what Drake does.
That's sample production.
Yeah,
which is really cool.
Yeah,
yep. What's that?
It's what made Daft Punk famous.
Sample production. Yeah. You can do cool stuff. Cool out of it. But the thing is, the only issue with that though is you just have to pay for the licenses for those samplings.
Mm-hmm.
Because like Avicii did a song that Pretty Lights did. Well, they used the same sample.
So, the Etta James sample.
Yeah.
Skrillex did one too.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Keep it right up.
So.
Get a feeling that I know.
Yeah, that sample.
Signed.
So. Yeah, so sample-based production isn't remixing, because like remixing, you're taking an like an artist's work and still giving them credit to the artist. Where sample-based production, you're making your own song using a little bit of another artist, but you're not giving credit. You're just paying for the license.
I think that's an important distinction that many people aren't aware of. Many listeners aren't aware of.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with sample-based production. I think it's really cool. Elijah used to go by the name Filthy Paw, and that's all he did. That's how he got his start, was in sample-based production.
Girl Talk as well.
Yeah. So.
Unfortunately, in today's day and age, it's much harder to do that. Sample songs.
It is.
Like, for example, like, mm-hmm. Blau got famous off of doing bootlegs. Now you can't do that anymore because the copyright laws have cracked down and that door of opportunity is closed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's terrible. It's really terrible because, like, people can get pretty creative, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like Blau did. I thought his bootlegs were amazing, honestly.
Yeah.
And I was a fan, but then SoundCloud got pressure from the big labels and they had to crack down on it, and now people can't make those stuff and put that stuff and post on SoundCloud anymore.
Yeah.
So it sucks.
Rough world out there. Rough world.
So yeah, I mean, the only reason I would see to make an unofficial remix is if it was of a popular track, to where it could get you higher in search engines. Like, for example, there's an artist named Nurko who made a remix of a Halsey song, which I played in my live stream set. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing remix, but he even said this in an interview, the only reason he made it as a marketing tool, because Halsey is a big name, but it's an unofficial remix. So, That would be the biggest benefit to that. But otherwise, the only way you're going to be able to get a remix like that on Spotify is if it's an official remix that the label supports.
Right.
So you got to remember, you guys doing unofficial remixes, everyone that's listening, make sure you put it as Creative Commons. All rights reserved, they will strike you down immediately. But Creative Commons, you have a little bit of a fighting chance.
Mm-hmm. Even though that's not what Creative Commons is supposed to be used for.
No, but it's a little it's a little cheap way around.
It freaks out. It spooks the algorithms. We'll say that.
Yeah.
Unless
those pesky algorithms.
Unless it's faxing Berlin, then you're fucked either way.
Creative Commons license is supposed to be used. So, like, if you released an original piece of work and you released it under a Creative Commons license, that tells the listener that they can make remixes of that song as long as they credit you. Mm-hmm. But if you put out a Creative Commons license on a remix, that's technically illegal. You're not allowed to do that.
Technically.
Yeah. So the way the SoundCloud and other algorithms are programmed is they treat it more liberally. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if the algorithms get smarter, your song is going to get taken down. So if you released an official remix or unofficial remix of something and it got a million plays on your SoundCloud profile in 5 years, if SoundCloud's copyright algorithm got super smart, your song is now taken down. So just like assess that risk at your own discretion.
And do not, I repeat, do not monetize your unofficial remix, because then you're going to get freaking sued, all right?
Yeah. Then you'll owe them a lot of money to be made.
You don't want to be in that world of hurt.
Right. Overproducing. That was something we talked, Matt and I talked about earlier, about like a pitfall to fall into. Like, it's easy once you're in like a state of flow to add too many layers or too many details, or to continue doubling back to things because you think you can make them perfect. Mm-hmm. Do you want to speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, so what brought up this idea for this conversation is I was showing Jesse a mixed session I did for a country band, and he noticed that my equalizers on every channel had barely any adjustments on them, and he was asking me like why I didn't like do any like EQ adjustments on them and stuff like that, and I told him that I thought that the sounds sounded fine the way they were and I didn't want to change them. So that's the thing, like, don't feel like you need to change something if it sounds good to you already.
Right.
Yeah, you had just a low cut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, if I could produce a song where I could find samples or instruments that just sounded really amazing as is and all blended well together, ideally I wouldn't have to use any compression, any EQ at all. So sample selection is pretty important.
Yeah. I'll second that.
So,
I froze.
When it comes to overproducing, is when you find a sample or something like that.
Steven froze.
He did.
Yeah, that sounds good in the mix. And you just EQ it because someone on Reddit told you to EQ it.
Right.
Then that's where things go south.
Right.
I just have some advice for that. Make sure you're taking breaks. You're producing, because then you're doing it too long, then you start getting frustrated, then you think you need to do something, and then you start overheating, and then you
ear
start
fatigue.
Yeah,
ear fatigue is huge. You don't hear things. You need to come back with fresh ears, even if it's a 10-minute break.
Happens to me all the time. I'm losing my hearing, so then the ear fatigue is like,
yo, that keeps me up at night. Why are you worried about losing your hearing? Or are you actually losing
it? I'm losing my hearing.
Yeah, it's happening to me too on my left ear. It's so, like, my headphones don't sound the same.
You guys should probably take like a week off from music and let your ears take a rest. Because I was just pumping loud music all the time all through college. Really messed up my ears. So my tinnitus is kind of bad now.
With tinnitus, you have it constantly?
It's like coming and going like a pulsing. So if, it, right. gets, like, I can't just sit here. Like, if the fan's off and I'm just listening to the wind hitting the trees out there, I can hear the rustling of the leaves, but I hear a low sine wave. Just kind of... Yeah.
Dude. All right, so listen to this. So I worry about...
If you can.
If you can. I worry about this because I'm worried that it might be a genetic thing, but my dad, when he was in his early 40s, he started to feel like his ears were clogged. Maybe like he had a cold, didn't think anything of it. And then it got worse and worse and worse. And finally he went to an ENT and then an audiologist. And they told him that he had nerve damage, no idea where it came from. And now he wears a hearing aid and you have to yell when you talk to him. But it was not induced by any like event that he can specifically remember. So I worry that like when I hit my early 40s, like my hearing is just gonna start to go. That's my worst fucking fear. So fucking
don't think about it. Then if you think about it, it's gonna happen.
I fucking hope not.
So
not the law of attraction, so
it's fine. Just do what Beethoven did. Just stick a metal fork, hold it with your teeth, and hold it next to a speaker.
Hear that sub. Feel that sub.
Feel it. Feel all of it.
Feel it. A good tip for people. I have a decibel reading app on my phone. So when I sit down to produce, I make sure that I'm producing always at under 70 decibels, because that's when they say damage starts to occur for long periods of time. So I make sure, I even go overboard. I make sure I'm producing at around 60 decibels to try and preserve my hearing long term.
Another good reference point is if you can still have a comfortable conversation with another person in the room with the volume that you're producing at, that's a good volume. If you can't comfortably have a conversation with like a co-producer or another artist, the song is too loud, so turn it down.
When did you start to notice some form of hearing loss, dude?
I would say about my senior year of college, so 3 years into college. It was bad then, like stuff would sound muffled. And so then I started realizing I think I'm producing way too loud. Especially because then I couldn't hear things, so then with my headphones on, I would turn the volume up so I could hear them. And that just kept adding on to it, adding on to it. And so then when I graduated, when I went home for that summer, I didn't produce for 3 months, right? And it gave my ears the break it needed to come back down, but it already caused damage.
Do you guys know how long it takes to recover from ear fatigue?
No.
It's supposed to be 14 hours. So if you've been producing all day for like 4 to 8 hours, it's gonna take about 14 hours for you to come back to regular. And now if you've been blasting your ears and you think it's gonna take a couple of days to come back, then you've been blasting it too loud.
But ear fatigue is not the same thing as hearing damage, correct?
Yes. Ear fatigue, your hearing will come back.
It's just your perception of the incoming sounds.
Yeah, it's like if you were in the gym and you did too many bicep curls. Like, you're gonna have to rest a bit.
Right.
Alright guys, thanks for tuning in to Where's the Hook? I'm Spiffy Man once again, and this is the rest of the label. Be sure to check in next month as we cover more topics. If you have anything you want us to discuss, you can send us an email, check in the description below, and we'll see you next time.
Peace, guys.